This is Alfred Beauvais, Editor-in-Chief of AXL. AXL is the American College of Cardiology Extended Learning Series, featuring conversations in cardiology with the scientists who conduct research in our field and the clinicians who are translating that research into clinical practice. You are about to hear an interview from our latest issue. As an AXL subscriber, you will receive 24 new interviews each month. Plus, depending on your subscription level, we'll have access to hundreds of interviews in our digital library. With AXL, you can stream or download your content for convenient offline access on your mobile device, and each interview qualifies for CME credit and MOC self-assessment points. For more information, visit acc.org/ACCEL. Listen now to a talk Alan Taylor had with Dr. Michael Picard, professor of medicine at Harvard School of Medicine in Boston, Massachusetts. They cover unusual cardiomyopathies, diagnostic considerations, and therapeutic implications.
Welcome, Michael.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Well, as we get into this topic, Michael, let's focus this down on a few key types of unusual cardiomyopathies. And I like your lecture this morning at the SNOMAS meeting. And in particular, you brought up four, I thought, that were common, and they're mimics. We learned that everything that is thick is not hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, and things that present in unusual ways can be important, unusual diagnoses. So, Michael, let's talk today about a few unusual cardiomyopathies and try to leave the listeners with some clinical pearls to improve their practice in the care of these patients. And four real common ones are amyloid, Fabry's disease, arrhythmogenic right ventricular cardiomyopathy, and left ventricular non-compaction, and maybe we can take them in that order. Amyloid, I think most clinicians detect amyloid or think of amyloid when they see a thick ventricle and reduced voltage on an electrocardiogram, but everything that's thick is not amyloid, isn't that right?
That's true, and as we'll see when we talk about some of the other ones, that we'll see wall thickness, not necessarily muscle hypertrophy, but wall thickness in a variety of these, not necessarily hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, but many other.
So a patient comes through the echo lab and they have an echo and there's the increased wall thickness. What's the next step in your thinking?
So when I'm looking at those echocardiograms, I'm looking at not just the wall thickness and the ventricular function, both systolic and diastolic, but I'm looking at the valves. Are they thickened? Because with amyloid infiltration, you'll see thickening of the valves. The interatrial septum will also get thick. We'll do the diastolic function assessment, looking for, as the LA pressure rises, we'll see reduced deceleration time on the mitral Doppler and that classic restrictive pattern. We're also using some newer technologies in echo, the strain rate imaging and strain imaging or speckle tracking. And global longitudinal strain is the current measurement that's in vogue. And when we do strain measurements, what we'll see is that strain is actually preserved in the LV apex, but it's reduced at the base and midventricular levels, which is very unusual for a cardiomyopathy. And that's a very, very specific sign of amyloidosis involving the heart.
Yeah, it's a great pearl. So as we get strain imaging more in our labs, thinking about this apical sparing in the strain of an amyloid patient might be a clue to diagnosis.
I think it's a clue, and it's something that will differentiate the other echoes that have thick walls. You'll see a more diffuse pattern of strain, of a reduction in global longitudinal strain.
Good to know. So what about other imaging? Pyrophosphate imaging was here in the past and was gone, and now seems to be back maybe for this indication.
Remember that with cardiac amyloidosis, we typically are looking at three different types. There's the light chain amyloidosis, there's the wild type transthyretin, and then the mutant transthyretin. And these transthyretin subtypes, when they occur, and particularly when they affect the heart, with the pyrophosphate scanning, you'll see the hearts light up really dramatically. And so it's now a test that's coming back, and is, again, a great tool to use when you've got the patient where you're concerned about amyloid. This can help clue you into the right diagnosis, and it clearly changes the treatment. Because if this is the transthyretin, we're going to treat it very differently than light chain. Light chain, obviously, it's chemotherapy, stem cell transplants. With the transthyretins now, we've got some medications that can maybe stabilize the transthyretin and reduce the cardiac involvement.
If you have a nuclear lab and you're currently not using pyrophosphate imaging, do you have a sense of how difficult it would be to initiate this type of imaging in your lab?
I suspect that the more seasoned clinicians who have the experience in the past won't find it very difficult. In fact, I think they'll be happy to see a renaissance in this imaging. And I think for the newer nuclear cardiologists, it's something that's readily available.
Let's move on then to Fabry's disease, a storage disease, but one that can come through the echolab with a thick ventricle. And it has a very particular phenotype, and we can identify it clinically. How does Fabry's disease present in your lab often?
So remember, this is an X-linked genetic disease, and so we're going to see it in males typically. And because it's a glycosphingolipid sort of stores, we're going to see thick hearts. Again, not necessarily hypertrophy of the muscle, but just thickening of the walls. And I want to make that distinction. So the clues for me are that when I've got a young patient, a young male, who's had a series of neurologic events, maybe several strokes or a seizure disorder, or has end-stage renal failure that doesn't have a clear-cut etiology, you need to think about Fabry's because this infiltration with the glycosphingolipid is not just in the heart, but also in the brain, in the kidneys, and in the skin. And so when I'm reading that echo, I see the thick walls, good function, it's a young person. Sure, I'm thinking about hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. I'm wondering about, is the renal failure causing hypertension, causing hypertrophy? But again, in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, well, don't forget Fabry's. Again, relatively rare disease, but we'll see it a few times a year.
Interesting. So it's this young patient with the stroke and renal failure is your clinical clue. Any patterns on the echo that separate a thick ventricle from Fabry's to just a thick ventricle from other causes?
So Fabry's can have the restrictive filling, although we typically will see these cases before they've really developed full-blown diastolic dysfunction. There are reports in the literature that as the glycosphingolipid deposits on the subendocardium, you'll actually see a bright endocardial line on the images of your LV. That should also clue you in that this could be Fabry's. I must say that it is not, in my experience, as sensitive and specific a sign as those original reports, which oftentimes is the case once we get it out into prime time.
So just like strain preserved at the apex and amyloid, an echo with some subendocardial enhancement might be indicative of Fabry's disease in a thick ventricle.
Sure. And then again, with complementary imaging, particularly with MR, with magnetic resonance imaging, we're going to see some of these types of signs too, I suspect.
All right, let's move now then to ARVC. It's the big right ventricle. It's the young person with arrhythmias and an important diagnosis with a risk for sudden death. In your echo lab, what do you see come through and what are your triggers to go on beyond the echocardiogram?
It seems like now in almost all the things we've talked about, there's this clinical history is really key. And again, we're dealing with the same situation. This is typically a young, most often male, maybe in their 20s to 30s, who's having a high burden of arrhythmias, maybe is presenting with sudden cardiac death as their first presentation, and then coming to the echo lab for that assessment of LV function because of their arrhythmias. And it's very striking that the LV function most commonly is normal, but the right ventricle is large, function is down, there may be aneurysms spaced out along the RV free wall. And particularly in the RV outflow tract, we'll see this enlargement, which again is when we look at the new criteria for diagnosing ARVC, when we get RV outflow tract dimensions above 32 millimeters, typically that's one of the signs that we use along with the ECG and the arrhythmia burden in making the diagnosis.
Interesting. So beyond the echo then, what's your next go-to imaging for imaging confirmation? It's tissue loss, it's fiber fatty replacement from a genetic defect.
Let's talk about the genetic defect for a sec, just to remind people that there are several mutations that have now been associated with ARVC. Many of them involve the gap junction. So many of the proteins there, gap junction proteins, which are involved in the cell-to-cell adhesion and the communication between cells. And as these gap junction proteins malfunction, the cells lose their connections and they drop out. There's apoptosis, and that's where the fat and the fibrous tissue infiltration occurs. But to go back to your question, we'll use the echo as a screen. If I got someone with suspicion for ARVC because of the echo findings involving the right ventricle, our next step is to go to cardiac MR. And when I order that cardiac MR, I specifically want an ARVC protocol. So I really want a fat suppression protocol because we want to image the muscle and not just the wall. And with fat suppression, looking at that RV, it's very striking when you have ARVC because the wall will be very, very paper thin. Now, it can be very challenging. Motion artifacts can lead to a false negative. If the fat suppression protocol is not done routinely at many institutions, they may not be familiar with that protocol. But again, the Hopkins group and several others have really laid the groundwork for this.
Great. So the pearl there, chase that fiber fatty replacement that's core to the fundamental mechanism of ARVC. And lastly, Michael, let's move on to left ventricular non-compaction. Most of the listeners are probably familiar with non-compaction as a diagnosis when there's excessive trabeculation against versus the myocardial wall thickness. There's problems with false positive diagnoses in this. And what pearls can you give around false positives? When to be suspicious, but when to think that it's a false positive?
So before we do that again, I want to step back for a second and just to remind people that the non-compaction has multiple forms, can be associated with congenital abnormalities or can be an isolated form. And we can see it relatively early where there's preserved LV function, but we can also see these patients presenting late where they have essentially a dilated cardiomyopathy. But in all of those cases, we're going to see that increased non-compacted myocardium compared to the compacted myocardium. And my impression is that as LVs dilate, even in a patient without non-compaction, as the ventricle dilates, when you look out on the apex, you're going to see these prominent trabeculations. That's not necessarily non-compaction. To improve your specificity for this diagnosis and reduce false positives, you really want to see the non-compacted myocardium at the midventricular level, particularly in the posterior and the lateral aspects of the myocardium. So in that short axis view on an echo, you want to look at the papillary muscle level and look for the non-compaction. On CT and MR, same thing, you really want to look at the midventricular level. Many patients, as I said, will even have the read on some of these studies as having non-compaction. And if you go back and look at the echo, it's really just trabeculations at the apex, and that may not necessarily be non-compaction.
So a great pearl there is to really make sure non-compaction is seen throughout the ventricle, particularly in the mid portions of the ventricle, not just at the apex, to make sure we don't false positive diagnose these patients. Well, thank you, Michael, for coming to Axel and bringing us these insights on amyloid, Fabry's disease, ARVC, and left ventricular non-compaction.
Great. Thanks for having me.
This is Alfred Beauvais, Editor-in-Chief of Axel, and you've been listening to an interview from our recent issue. For more information on how to subscribe to Axel and receive additional interviews published each month, go to acc.org/accel.